How's everybody doing?
We're doing great. Just here we are.
Nothing better than starting an episode an hour late. But
yep, that's what's happening.
Yeah. That was entirely
1 hour
Anthony's
late.
Fault. So,
well, half.
Nope.
Three quarters.
I don't care what technical difficulties we had after you showed up. It was all because of you. Sean, I hear you're getting a spray tan.
I am. I'm getting a spray tan soon.
So I have been blinded. I roomed with you. So, and you would wear a bathrobe consistently. But actually, what I experienced the most when I roomed with Sean is that he would come back from class. He would strip down to his white undershirt and his boxers, and then he put a bathrobe on. So I've been blinded by
your, comfortable.
I've been blinded by your blazingly white thighs for a large portion of my college experience. Why the spray tan now? What's happening here?
I lost a bet with my students. Once a year, I give my students a chance to torture me in some way. We get, you know, through the organization Samaritan's Purse, they do Operation Christmas Child. And so if they get enough boxes, you know, get enough stuff packed for Christmas, then I let them choose something to do to me. So last year, they did it as well. And you guys know I'm vegan. I don't eat meat. And they forced me to eat a steak in front of them. So like for chapel, they cooked a steak and I had to eat a steak in front of them during chapel.
That's one of the most savage things. Like normally that would be like off limits.
You have
limits,
no boundaries on it.
But that's wild.
Yeah.
They just made you eat a dead animal.
I respect the commitment.
Yeah, so some nice students.
It's junior high. I mean, this is par for the course.
Allowing you to eat something that's actually good. But
was the steak good?
I'm going to be honest, I didn't enjoy it. Like they made mashed potatoes and asparagus next to it. Those were the best parts of the meal. My palate is not used to that.
Here's the thing that I want to discuss right now. And, you know, I understand that you're students, they're young, and so we have to give them the benefit of the doubt. But if we're thinking about this ethically, you raised a bunch of money to be able to benefit, you know, a charitable organization, which is going to benefit countless lives. But the cost of that was the death of an animal. So are your students ethical people? That's really what I want to know.
Oh, I can answer that. We don't even need to go into this premise to ask if my students are ethical people. I already can tell you the answer to that.
This is a junior high teacher who's had two.
Only slightly jaded.
Yeah.
It's literally a daily catastrophe. That's what we call it. That's junior high.
Wow.
No, but
I mean, I get that. I get that we would call your classroom that, but how about the rest of the classroom?
Yeah,
like is that?
Yeah, no, it's specifically me. I am the problem. The spray tan will be interesting. I haven't fully researched yet where I'm going to get it done, but it's going to. They told me it has to be the darkest setting, so we'll see what that ends up resulting in.
Wow.
I don't know what that's going to look like.
I'm literally thinking about Robert Downey right now. Tropic Thunder.
I'm really excited.
All of our nurse.
What do you mean, you people?
I'm really excited to see you looking like a British girl, like on Love Island or something like that. That's just like, you know.
Oh, true.
That's what I'm.
Well, we'll have to record another episode. When Sean has a spray tan, all of our
post spray tan
loyal viewers can soak it up.
Anthony, I mean Sean. it's going to happen multiple times in the episode. If anyone is listening and not watching, Anthony is black, Sean is white. But with the spray tan, Sean would be darker. He would match Anthony's color. That was the joke, just for our listeners.
The listeners are loyal, Jesse. They know. They're loyal. They're with us.
Speaking of loyal listeners, guys, we got a new review on iTunes.
Oh, let's read it.
So I'm going to read it.
Should we play a game where you read the review and we guess how many stars it is?
I'm ready. Let's do it. Eric, go.
I feel like it's going to be pretty easy. Okay. So this comes in from MG241. Thank you for putting your real name out there. It says, I've been away from the church, but I'm now trying to reconnect with my Adventist beliefs and, of course, have a relationship with God. We need more podcasts like this with relatable, funny people that make you feel like you're hanging out and having a discussion amongst friends. I hope you produce content more often, guys. May God bless your work.
Wow.
1 star.
Yeah.
Yuck.
I'm just kidding. Sorry, wrong podcast. I had to leave this on.
Thanks, MG.
Thank you.
Words, my friend.
Thanks for listening. If any listeners want to leave a review, we might try to read it on an episode.
Yeah.
So
I'm really looking forward to I want to read a bad review. Like,
that's true.
I'm really looking forward to
if
that.
You even if throw it's us a bad off, review. If you guys want
you
to
can leave a
off,
bad review, just, but make it 5 stars.
Yes.
Exactly. Or the opposite. Yeah, or just say like, amazing podcast, 1 star.
We have a 3.2 rating because everyone's just doing that to us. It's been cool, guys. I appreciate everyone who listens, and it's a kind of a wild thing. We talk about this consistently on the podcast. We started this and we're like, it's just our moms and some of our friends who are gonna listen to this, but it's been cool. I think here at Loma Linda, I end up at least on average a couple of times a week, someone tells me they've been listening to the podcast. And so it's pretty cool. And glad you guys are out there listening. I'm breaking the fourth wall. And so pretty much Deadpool right now. So,
I want to do the same thing. Shout out to Carlina. You just told me yesterday that you are a podcast listener. Carlina, what an honor, friend. Be blessed. How cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. So one of the things that we've been trying to do for a long time is to be like relatable, and also we want to be ourselves while also exploring Adventism. But one of the things that we had been trying, what in the world was that sentence? We've been wanting to try.
Try
That's
again.
What I was trying to
try
say.
Try again.
One of the things that we've been wanting to try is listener questions. And so we want to encourage you guys to send in your questions. And as a panel of people that are incredibly well-versed in every part of biblical study, who have...
We know everything.
Yeah, we have already solved Adventism, so we're ready to solve your problems is what exactly what it is. So if you want to send in your questions...
So
we're gonna be like Dr. Laura.
Can I submit the first listener question?
You sure
for
can,
this
brother.
For this series, we'll see where this goes.
This is slightly terrifying.
But since I'm like, the most biblically literate and theologically sound of the four of us, I figured like I'll let you guys take the spotlight for a minute. Cause I don't want to
appreciate that.
Take the podcast.
Yeah.
Too much. So
we don't want Earth to get a big head.
You're generally the most wordy on the podcast.
I'm trying to like share the spotlight here.
Yeah.
So but no, so yeah, basically I kind of had an idea for potentially kind of an ongoing series of episodes that we can do where, we can read a listener question that somebody sends in, or if I just come up with something to ask you guys, but basically asking some of those like genuinely tough questions that we kind of like to not think about, or maybe you just don't really wrestle with until you kind of come to a point where like this doesn't necessarily make sense to me. And I think for me, some of those questions started coming up again when I became a dad, because I'm like, what, you kind of like start teaching your kid about God and stuff.
Yep.
And you're like, sometimes when you're like, you're teaching it to a child, you're like, does this like how much of this, you become more of these questions come up, be like, this kind of seems like weird, or like, how like firm do I believe
propaganda?
This certain thing, and how do I...
my favorite thing is to be reading like the story of Noah's Ark, and they have all the like, because kids love animals and they love like all the colors of all that stuff, so like, it's a great story to read to kids. But then in the middle of it, it's like, yeah, and God closed the doors to the ark, and then it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and then then God said to send, or then Noah sent out these animals. I was like, well. And they miss the thousands of people drowning. And it's just, and then I just throw that in there. Well, my kids are too young. They don't know. They don't like, they don't understand that word.
Right.
So I'm just trying to, I'm just trying to get it out early. And everybody
You're trying to lead.
Yeah. So,
yep. Yeah. No, there's a lot. Yeah. That's a good example. And, that's a good segue into maybe my first question is,
okay, we're ready.
When I read the Bible, I honestly have a very hard time reconciling the God of the Old Testament and Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I know there's like some, you know, big picture stuff that's there. And so I want to get this sense of like, I feel like I just like can't see it at all, but it is something like I do wrestle with, because to me, it feels like Jesus is so personal and like cares about each individual. And then you go to the Old Testament and it feels like God is, of course, like long suffering at times, but also it's like, it's all about God. And it feels much more egotistical, to put it plainly.
Less personal.
Yeah, yeah. So like, maybe an example of that is like, you know, the story of Job. You know, it's like God takes one of like his best guys and puts him like through hell and kills his children. And it's all just like a game to God, like a bet with the devil kind of thing. And sure, like at the end, it's like, oh, Job's life got better and he was wealthier and had more people. But it's like, he had new kids, but it's like, good for them, but sucked for his old kids that got murdered. It's like, you know, I don't know. So, okay,
but to be clear, what if his old kids just sucked? Like, what if they were...
Maybe they just...
That's all.
Maybe they had it coming.
I mean, doesn't the story kind of say they did? Like, no, I don't think Job constantly going and sacrificing for them to, like...
That's true, yeah.
You know? Because
yeah.
they were willing all the time.
A whole new
so doesn't mean they suck.
Let's just start over. What are your guys' thoughts?
But yeah, that's a genuine.
No, that was a lot. But
yeah, I feel like I'm really glad we're starting on the easiest question that you could have thrown at us.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
So, I was like softball, and then we can get into the deep stuff later.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm not like looking for you guys to solve this for me. You know, it's something I have to continue to like explore and ask these questions. But I know, I think it'd just be beneficial for me and for the listeners to hear you guys' thoughts. So I know you're not that smart to like solve it, but
thanks. Appreciate that.
He's like, I know none of you are smart enough to answer this.
One of the places I generally start to answer on this question is in Jeremiah chapter 50. Eric, do you want to look that up? Jeremiah 50. And then it's verse 12. And the reason I start here is because it just really sets the tone for, kind of everything that we have to talk about. Like, you have to kind of set a foundation to be able to talk about it from here on out. So, I don't know, Eric, do you want to just read it? It's really the first line.
Sure. Jeremiah 50, 12 says, "Your mother will be greatly ashamed.
Yep.
She who
gave
that was birth
it. That was it. So,
be disgraced."
So, just for because you,
you
asked
Jesse,
this because
that.
You asked this question, I just wanted to read some scripture. That was
oh my word.
Should I dive into some other scriptures for you guys?
"Your mama will be greatly ashamed" is what that was. I had that.
We've been recorded one of these in a while, so we got duped by Jesse being.
I've been waiting to use that. It's the best "Your mama" that I can bring out in the Bible. So
he baits you with genuineness on the reel, the proverbial fish hook.
Okay, if we're gonna actually address this, I feel like we got to start in I guess this basic philosophical thing, which is that we separate the two, you know, and I know we like most people would say, okay, God and Jesus are the same, but then the problem that you're bringing out is it feels like they're different, right?
Right.
And so like the philosophical thing that we have to maybe do first is say, if the Bible claims that God and Jesus are one, God, Jesus, the Holy Spirit are one, then we may have to start from that philosophical standpoint of just like, there has to be some sort of reconciliation here, or God is just like wildly bipolar and going all over the place into different moods, depending on whatever it is. So like, that's where I would just start from, like maybe a philosophical space, is that if we're going to claim that they're the same, then we have to start from that place that the Jesus that we see in the New Testament is the God that we see in the Old Testament too. And then we have to rationalize the two. So I'm sure you already have thought about that, but that like, that's maybe a good foundation to start from. And then the next thing that I would maybe just ask is, how much do we think like culture or people or times and places, how much do we think that that demands different types of interaction? Because for instance, like we've been talking about kids a lot, there's a completely different way that I interact with my 3-year-old, my 1-year-old than right now than I will when they're 20 and 22, you know? And so I'm not saying any of this right now to like make airtight arguments, but I'm just saying like, we kind of already have that I can be the same father, but I would need to interact with my kids differently at different times and spaces, or I need to interact with someone who's from a different culture differently than I would interact with someone who's from a culture that I'm familiar with, you know? So there's, I guess, two places we start from like, we have to get into the rest of it, but that's two places that I would start if we're talking about looking at these seemingly two different experiences of God.
So you're saying that perhaps the culture of the Old Testament, like obviously there's a lot of years there that were kind of, that gets boiled down into, you know, pages, but that basically God needed to interact differently with that culture than maybe the time of Jesus.
I think that's at least a piece. Not trying to say like right now, here's the airtight argument to the whole thing, but just more like, here's one piece of the puzzle and then we'll add more, you know, to it all.
Sure.
But yeah, I think that's one piece.
I guess maybe one question that comes to my mind with that is, do you feel like the core, like, I don't like this term, but like human condition is the same across like time and culture though?
Oh, what do you mean by that question?
Like, I guess like the core like human needs and ways that we interact of like, we all need love and acceptance and...
Oh, yeah. Like Maslow's hierarchy.
People, you know, I don't know, like, I'm not that philosophical necessarily, but I guess I'd argue that there's just certain core human things that make us human that kind of are the same regardless of like time or culture. Obviously, they change slightly, but there's just like that, those core human needs that we have that in a way feels like that's the heart of like where, you know, we interact with God and where God lives.
Well, it is kind of like the thing I'll say to this, Eric, and it's not answering your question per se, but the relationship with God between Old and New Testament would have been quite different. And just the general draw towards being in relationship with God. So you have the aspect of, I guess, New Testament. So Jesus, it feels more personal because you have this aspect of a savior. And for them during that time, right, well, he was still on earth. It was like you could see and touch him. You could talk to him. And then afterwards, there's still this personal aspect of like having a personal relationship with Jesus versus in the Old Testament, there seems to be a different emphasis on what a relationship with God looks like. And now there's still obviously those that have, you know, the ability to talk personally to him, both pre and post fall, you know, in the garden. But it does seem to be a different way of interacting with God. Or, you know, if you're living pre Jesus, there's no sense of like, you know, you look forward to, I guess, the prophecies, you know, if you were a Jew, you knew what the prophecies said, whether you fully understood them or not, that there'd be a Messiah figure. But obviously there was a split on how people understood that and what they really were expecting. But, you know, we're in a space where we celebrate what Jesus did on the cross and through his resurrection. That was just not a practice for God followers for most of history. You know, they didn't have the cross to celebrate. They didn't have the resurrection to celebrate, you know. It's like they were living in a time and space where sin and death had not yet been defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a different, so I don't know if that's an important, how important that piece is to this question, but it partly maybe speaks to maybe why God interacts differently, or maybe his agenda long-term, mm-hmm. the way he's approaching life during those times would be different than what is happening during Jesus's life and after Jesus goes back to heaven. So then it makes you think about, well, why does God do this or doesn't do that? And then you get to that core question, right? And you just go throughout the Old Testament and say, well, what's the purpose of this? What's the long-term goal God has here? And does that mm-hmm. align with the character that I see God as? Does that portray a God of love, you know, a God of justice? And then well, this, on another layer of that is, well, I was just going to say, I was just going to say really quick, Jesse, that other layer is what I read. Sorry, there's a delay in the audio, so I couldn't hear what you cut in, but.
That's fake.
Garbage. It's so
He's faking it.
Oh, my word. But it's also, Eric, like what I read into it. Like if I, what do I come into it expecting a God of love to look like? Right. Mm-hmm. So beyond just the agenda of like understanding the context of what God was to his people back then and what he was trying to do, what do I see as being just? What do I see as being loving? You use the word egotistical. How do we define that? What are the markers of someone that is being egotistical versus not? And that's what makes this question so challenging, is we all come into the text with different lenses of what we expect or what mm-hmm. we would, you know, when we would think of love or goodness mm-hmm. or justice. And so that makes it difficult as well to always address the root of what we're looking for. So anyways, those are the pieces that came to my mind.
Yeah, I think maybe part of what I wrestle with is that I think in many ways, and maybe I could just get more into this in another episode, because I have more questions about this, but in many ways, I feel like Jesus is sort of an antithesis to a God figure. Mm. You know, he's just like very not mm-hmm. what you would expect God to be like if he came down to earth.
Yeah.
Right. And so maybe that's a kind of a part of what makes it hard for me to like fully mesh those together, is because on like a big scale level, you know, it feels like Jesus is all about God coming down and like reaching out to us in a mm-hmm. way. And the Old Testament feels very not that way, where it's mm-hmm. it's like us reaching up to God. And
that's really interesting. What you just said is actually a big piece we should come back to, which is that in one mm-hmm. side it feels like God reaching out to us, and the other, in the Old Testament, it feels like us reaching up to God. Like that feels like a pretty stark contrast. And so I totally see that that dissonance. What were you gonna say, Anthony?
I think something that helps with this a lot, and probably where I would start, if someone asked me pastorally about this, is just understanding biblical narrative. Well, two things really. One is understanding biblical narrative, which is to say, what is the big story that the Bible is telling? Like, what's the problem? And right, we have, just in brief, we have like God's creation in his good world has pretty much rebelled and rejected his kingdom and decided to live defining good and evil on their own terms, and wanting to build their own kingdom separate from him. And so God, because he's good and because he's love, wants to redeem and restore the world, even though his creation has rebelled against him. So this is like the big story meta narrative that the Bible is telling, right? That God is somehow, he's trying to redeem and restore everything back to his original intention, but he's trying to do it in a way that isn't manipulative. And I think that's what the story of Job illustrates in a lot of ways. You know, this is where we bring in like a little Adventist, very Adventist of me to bring in, Jesse doesn't like this term, but the intergalactic rebellion, which is my term for the great controversy. Right. But I think the Job story illustrates greatly what, like, why God takes the strategy he does between Old and New Testament, because the main accusation of the Satan, the accuser, is that, like, that God is a manipulative tyrant, that God is a gaslighter, that God is an abuser, that God, he gains power manipulating people.
He's manipulated Job into praising him by blessing him.
Right.
And that if those things were taken away, Job would have no reason to do so. That's at least the argument made.
Exactly. So in that sense, God has to somehow, I think Rob Bell talks about this, like, use the
Here
side roads
goes.
Instead of the highway.
Here he goes. I'm a, Rob Bell.
I'm a heretic. I'm about to use another Rob Bell illustration too, right after this. Therefore, God has to use the back roads to redemption rather than the highway, which would just be like snapping his fingers and making it all go away and fixing it. But because of, you know, if he does that, then it just plays into the you know, accusation that he's a manipulator. Oh, you just saved the world because you're manipulating them to serve you, right? So therefore, he has to kind of go roundabout. So the second thing that I think helps is another one of Rob Bell's illustrations, which is the difference between hard power and soft power. And he talks about this, like, soft power is like the smell of freshly baked bread in the other room, and it just kind of compels you to go check it out, like cookies that were just made by your grandma or whatever. My family's mm-hmm. Caribbean, so they're making black cake probably with a little bit of rum in it.
Anthony got fired.
It just... Well, I had it when I was like 11.
It bakes out.
Grandma
got
arrested.
It bakes out.
What happened?
It bakes out. It bakes out. Although the rum bakes out. But it's like, you know, freshly baked bread in the other room. It compels you. Hard power is like a nuke or like a hammer that you use on a nail.
Such
I know
a
those are two very, it's a wide scale, but it's the same idea. It's like
freshly
you're using
baked,
power to control
bread.
Something.
Freshly baked bread and a nuke in the other room.
Exactly. One is like ultimate power. The other one, it just kind of compels you, kind of woos you, you know, with how good it smells. So he talks about how because God has this overarching plan, the whole plan in the Bible is to redeem and restore the world, but he's doing it through the back roads, not the main highway. He's using soft power for most of the story, but every now and then he has to use hard power because God is good. And when evil reaches a certain threshold, he needs to step in because he wants to redeem the world. So therein, there lies a few moments along the way of the Old Testament where he steps in and uses hard power because he wants to redeem the world.
Like there's sort of a putting to bed evil. Like there is a point at which God steps in. So it isn't just an Old Testament God that does those things.
Yeah.
Point there.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, and eventually God uses his ultimate hard power and just says evil is finished, which is good news. But
it's hard because to assess the power of God, like why he does certain things, you can always, you know, my question will always be, what's the alternative? If God didn't do it this way, what was the other option? And even then, that will get you in some cases a better understanding, but other times too, there are times you'll just kind of look at a situation, you know, people, you know, very frequently will point to, you know, when people are killed, when there's, you know, various battles or things where you're just like, God, why this? Or why does it feel so harsh here, right? With the Israelites, you know, and there's still harshness in the New Testament. I mean, when I look at the treatment of Ananias and Sapphira, I still struggle. You know, there are stories where you say,
that's an interesting story.
Why is
it recently?
Right. Well, and the question is like you get, because what happens is you get to a certain point, like, okay, I get why they needed to be punished or why this wasn't right, but why in this case is there so little room for mercy? Or someone like Uzzah in the mm-hmm. Old Testament, he touches the ark and he's gone. And I get that there's conversations, there's been sermons and people that have done commentaries on the seriousness of those things and the natural consequence of, you know, God's holiness, right? But there's still that ultimate challenge that I think a lot of people, Eric, resonate with what you're saying is when you get to certain spots where you're reading, you're like, God, why does it have to be this way? Was there not an alternative method for approaching mm-hmm. this situation that would have resulted in a similar redemption arc for humanity. And that's a hard, yeah. you know, that's a hard road to go down, because we can't answer that. We can't always, you know, some people try, they try to say, well, this, if God did it this way, it would have been more merciful. It would have been more redemptive. But there's, you know, I don't know if you guys have found it any easier, but it's, you know, you can go case by case, and it's a, you have to wrestle with it.
For some people it's hard, but you know, when you really know Jesus.
I will say that the Ananias and Sapphira story is interesting. I read that recently for Bible study. And what's wild about, and I'm not saying that these stories are difficult, but, and that story is difficult, but when you read it, it's, ooh, it's really interesting. The text never says God kills them. Peter seems to think that that's the way Peter interprets their death, but the text, the author never says that it's the Spirit that kills them. And it's kind of odd, because in Acts, you would think, like the Spirit is like the main character in Acts. So the Spirit is acting a lot, and the author will write, the Spirit did this, the Spirit came to Paul in a dream, mm-hmm. the Spirit this. But it never says the Spirit kills them. It just says he fell over and died, and she comes in and tells him, and then she falls, and then Peter, like, he almost like seems to prophesy that she'll die too, and then she does. So you could make the argument that God does, but it's a mysterious story. Interesting one.
Yeah.
I will say another piece of it to me too is, like, to go back to what you said, Eric, about the New Testament or Jesus feeling like God reaching out to us, and then Old Testament feeling like it's us reaching out to God. When you go back to that narrative that Anthony was talking about, what's so intriguing to me is that at the beginning in the garden, there's none of that. Either way, it's just a mutuality to the relationship, it seems. I mean, there's the condescension of a God to created beings, but, like, I mean, that's pretty crazy in and of itself. But then after there's a breaking, there's sort of like there's a really cool narrative arc to the whole story. So, like, from Genesis 3 to really, I think it's somewhere in Exodus, I think Exodus 33, pretty much that God's, like, there's the God of, in the garden. So God, or us with God in the garden. But then there's this breaking, God's separated from us, or us separated from God. And then you get to Exodus 33, and it talks about, I think it's 33 or is it 35. Anyways, it talks about how, the people of Israel at that time, they would go outside of the camp to go and meet with God. And so it really is kind of like a journey to go to where God is, you know, and then if we get there, mm-hmm. then we can talk to God. And Moses meets God there in this chapter and stuff. But it's at that place that ultimately, like, that God is dwelling at that point. But then God sets about this whole plan. He's like, I want to live among you. Like, I want to live in the midst of you. And that's where you get the whole sanctuary thing. And so then you have all of this context. Mm-hmm. How does a holy God who is totally outside of time and space and all of these, maybe, I don't know how we want to describe, like, this other dimensional, whatever the heck God is type of thing. Like, how does that God interact in a, mm-hmm. in a way that is helpful and humane to humans? There's a lot of, like, trying to get figured out. But then that goes on until we get to, finally, Jesus, who is God with us, like Emmanuel, God with us. So we have us with God in the garden, and then there's a separation, and then it's God outside the camp, then God in the midst of the camp, and then it's God with us in Jesus. Until finally in the mm-hmm. in Acts, Jesus says, I'm going to leave and I will send the Spirit. And then it's not just God with us, it's God in us, God dwelling in us. Mm-hmm. Until finally there's a restoration to us with God someday. And so, yes, you're actually, I think you're hitting on something that is present in the narrative, that there seems to be a slightly different thing that's happening. But what's kind of interesting is the whole narrative arc is a consistent closer and closer and closer until ultimately there's restoration in the end. And so, is that a different God, or is that a God interacting differently with people based on kind of space and time in the stories? And mm-hmm. one of the things that I find interesting, because people, you know, might ask, like, well, why not just do that quicker? And I definitely have had that question myself, but I also have come to realize from being a pastor, there's some situations and some people that I'm like, I want to tell you exactly what to do and how to solve this.
Yep.
And in some of these cases, I'm actually very confident that what I would have to say would at least make a dent in shifting the trajectory of life, right? It's not like I'm trying to save their lives, but I just know that what I have to say would genuinely shift the trajectory of their life. But it, they are not in a place to be able to
hear it.
Or if they can hear it, they won't act on it. Or if they won't, if they try to act on it, it will go through this cycle of continual like steps back until it falls away. There is at some point that someone is ready, or there is even at some point that a people group is ready. And that's what's kind of challenging for me in all of this too, is that there is a God who is dealing with people and culture as they shift and change over time. Like I even think, you know, regardless of Christians who want to say that this is a good thing or not, like I think about even the question about the queer community. There, for a long time, even amongst the secular spaces, there wasn't necessarily a full acceptance of being gay or gay marriage, right? And then all of a sudden, culture has these specific key moments that happen where that becomes way wider, way more widely accepted within culture. But culture almost had to come to a point where then through a series of events, there is an opening, a different argument is made. Someone finally says something that sounds different than what has been said before, or science opens up, you know, whatever it might be. And so we finally come to those points where then we can actually hear. And so I guess I just wonder, and we look, I mean, and one last bit of this is like, we look at our kids, there's a certain point at which our kid can hear, like, hey, you should be nice to people. But there's, that takes a long time for them to get that concept. Before that, you have to actually instill like specific actions that are nice. Like even like this after this evening, my wife was like, when you do things that are nice to your brother, she's saying this to my my daughter, when you do things that are nice to your brother, we're going to like praise that. And then my daughter was like, I don't, and so one time my daughter was doing something that was negative towards her brother. And my wife's like, well, what could you have done differently? And my daughter just says, I don't know. Cause she just didn't like, she doesn't have the concrete capacity to understand what I should do next. So there's like, at this point, we're going to say, well, here's the concrete thing that you should do. But then over time, hopefully she gains the concept of what nice is. And then hopefully over time, she builds on that concept and has to work through the nuance of what life is, where there's being nice to somebody who is there to receive it. There's being nice to someone who's going to take advantage of you. How do you act in those spaces? Like there's so much nuance and complexity to life that you're going to be able to hear different things in different stages. And so you can have one person, say a parent, who is the same person through every season, but who has to say different things, or has to teach it in a different way, or maybe even has to be more black and white in one season and then more open in another season. And so I say all of that just to say, I don't think you're wrong in noticing that God seems to be doing something different, but the trajectory is always towards an increasing closeness to God. And then the last thing I'll say about this is there's people in the Old Testament who seem to have that closeness with God. Like I think of a guy like David, or there's other people throughout the story who like, they have that personal relationship with God that is very much like the kind of thing you might see with Jesus later on. And so was it that God wasn't acting that way? Or was it that there were so many people who were taking what God was saying and then going a different direction with it? And so that opens up different arguments, but I don't know. That's just some more stuff to throw at it.
No, yeah. I mean, I appreciate everything you guys have said. I think it's definitely, you know, some good thoughts, and it's making me think more. It's just, it's, yeah, I think it's tough because there's just so much that goes into our like worldview and how we see God and what our place is in the big picture. And I think it's sometimes hard to, I don't know if it's balance or whatnot, but maybe it's just because in modern Christianity, we kind of put so much emphasis on a personal relationship with God, right? That's kind of like the buzzword, like the main core thing. If you ask like a Christian, it's like, what do you really need? It's like a personal relationship with Jesus. And yeah, it's just like, it's like challenging when you kind of grow up and that's like your kind of your mindset, that to maybe it's easy to try to think the right words to put this, I think it's sometimes it's hard to balance, like, God cares about me mm-hmm. as an individual person, and so maybe look at the Old Testament and feel like I can see God directing the big picture over like thousands of years.
Yeah.
But like, he doesn't seemingly care about the individual people for a vast majority of the human population, you know?
Like, and
I'm not saying that's an accurate or fair assessment always, but.
But I get what you mean.
It doesn't seem that way.
Yeah, I get what you mean, because the focus tends to be corporate, and then there's these vast, like, sweeping actions that, like, it seems like God.
Right.
I think of, like, the rebellion of Korah in the story of the Exodus from Egypt. Like, there's this rebellion mm-hmm. at some point, and God tells them,
I'm going to open up the air.
Yeah, and swallow you up, you know? It's like, dang, and, like, with their families and everything. But I also,
it's hard to imagine Jesus doing that, right?
When doing
Jesus
the same
is still
thing,
like,
yeah.
kind of passive.
Let me open up a chasm.
Right. So, but there's a whole other series of things that I would say that adds to this. Again, this isn't like, these aren't blanket answers that would just end up like,
right.
oh yeah, this is with the intention of solving everybody's issue. But like, there's more things to throw at it. Like when you have a king, or like if we have a president today, we expect the president to do specific things in their role, right? So, you know, in this, you know, this has happened in the past, or it could happen in the future. Like, if the United States is attacked, then we would expect at some point that our president would do something to ensure that that doesn't happen again, or to bring to justice those who attacked us, right? There's just a general expectation that that would be a piece of what happens. How that should happen exactly, you know, like what's ethical, what's not, like that all ends up being bigger conversations, but like we just expect that. And so when you go back culturally to think of cultural context, like if you are a group of people who are living in a theocracy, and I don't mean that to be a fancy word, but pretty much it just describes like God is our king. Like that's the way this works. God is the king, and everything that he says is what we should do. Then the king also has certain responsibilities in that context that are totally foreign to what we would think of when we would think of how someone ought to interact with someone today, because we don't live in that society. We don't live in that structure. And so when there's a rebellion, like there's the, leave the people who have rebelled in the middle of the camp to continue to foment that same destructive attitude, which is ultimately going to cause a massive split down the middle, all that stuff. And also, these people who are creating this, they may not even realize it, but they are leading an entire group of people towards a pathway that could be apart from their king, which would lead to them being powerless out in the middle of the desert to become slaves again, or to become killed at the hands of more powerful forces. Right? Like, there's consequences past this that if you're in the middle of that, you might feel more presently than we do reading it, you know, reading this from my desk. In a completely like mm-hmm. in a safe society overall, right? So it's like, if I'm one of the people, if I'm a dad with my kids in the tent behind me and I'm watching this happen, I'm like, what these people do has real consequences to my life and to how this goes from here on out. Because if they decide we're all going back to Egypt, well, okay, well now we're all back in slavery. So God as king at that point steps in and does something that, like, if we saw a earthly king at that time do that, he'd be like, you're either all exiled, you have to leave, or you're all going to be, you know, executed here in this space. What we see is God on a God scale do what we would expect a king to do over his kingdom. And now I'm not trying to argue about the ethics or anything about that right now. I'm just saying, like, role-wise at this point, right? And so, mm-hmm. like, if we're talking different roles, well, yeah, Jesus is totally different in presentation because he's not the king of a theocracy in the same way at this point that God is at that point in the Old Testament. And so when he shows up, he still is a king, but you even see it then, what you see echoes of, or at least hints towards back in the Old Testament, which is that he has always been a servant king. He's not a God who's expecting them to bring a bunch of gifts to him so he can like stockpile wealth and glory. He's always been, I'm going to bless you with everything that I have so that you will bless the world. That's always been the point. And so then Jesus shows up and then models that like individual human reality of this is what it looks like to be a king, but not just a king, but like a human being made in the image of God who has the power of God at his fingertips and yet lays it down for the good and the sake of others, right? So you see hints and echoes of that all the way back in the Old Testament, but in a different context with a different people or with a different time and place. And then you come to Jesus and it's a different time and place. He's acting as that. And then you go to a different time and place later on in Revelation where God shows back up as king, where Jesus shows back up as king, and he's acting as a king again, but with some different context. Like he's coming to defeat evil, but the defeat of evil also means that people who are caught up in evil and have chosen it are caught up in the destruction of evil. That's not something we would love to say, but it's also a, like, how else is that going to go, you know? And then also he is a king who comes in power, not as like this humble servant, but in power. So he's not different as Jesus and then the God of Revelation showing up in power, but yet he's also slightly different in emphasis at those different times, depending on time and place. So again, I'm not saying this like this is not trying to say this is airtight as much as like that's kind of what we see, what I have seen played out in different ways.
I think building on that a little as well, like I think that two things. One is distance from culture and the other one is like strategy. Like I think that we, because we live in a post-enlightenment, like 21st century era, like, you know, era, we have this idea looking at the past that, number one, that we are intellectually superior than people that lived before us, and also that we should be able to understand everything, like culturally, where when I think we, like, the mere concept that you and I are individuals is like a new concept in human history. Like, people pre-enlightenment didn't really think that way. Like, they thought in communal groupthink, not like full group, like hive mind stuff, right? But they thought as a community.
There's the element of the individual, but there's so much more about how the individual will impact the community rather than now we tend to think that I can almost be an island unto myself.
Exactly. So, like, it makes sense. Then we talk about strategy. It makes sense from a God perspective that in a culture and time when people in a worldview sense, like literally did not think of themselves primarily as individuals, but rather as communal, that he would approach them communal. He would approach them in a sense that made sense to them, that they could grasp, that they could understand, that he would encounter them and speak to them in a communal way. But then when Jesus comes, he comes and he speaks in an individual way once that has shifted and changed, right? Because this is post Plato, this is post Aristotle, when the era when Jesus comes, people are beginning to think of themselves more as individuals, and so it makes sense that he would like shift strategy. And then I think there's also another word on strategy
Just to point out, there's even like God meets people in good ways communally as well. It's not just like communal punishment. You look at Rahab. Anyone who's in Rahab's house when Jericho falls is also saved. They've done nothing, you know, but like communally by association, there is, you know. So it's interesting. It's just like it's a cultural element that we're not super familiar with today.
We're not as connected. And even Jesus does the same thing with like Zacchaeus. You know, he's like, based on what you've done today, you and everyone in your home is justified.
Yeah.
Like he'll do that too. But I also think like there's a shift in strategy. I think that you see. Because again, if we're thinking of the Bible as a big narrative where God is trying to redeem a world that has rebelled against him, that has chosen to build their own kingdom apart from his kingdom, and I think this is a little bit harder if you're not like familiar with original languages and stuff, but there are like so many like weird spiritual undercurrents to like the way the Hebrew describes like other nations and other gods. And then later on in the Bible, like Paul will go on to tell us that like these idols that people worship, they're actually demonic powers. So we know that God in the Old Testament, he's kind of on hostile territory, right? Because this was his kingdom, his world that he made. But then the humans, he gives them dominion and they essentially give away their dominion to the devil, which is why Jesus will call Satan later on the current king of this world, the current prince of the earth. Mm-hmm. So when God is on the earth acting the Old Testament, he's acting as a God in hostile territory, so to speak, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And so I think to 21st century readers, when we read it through our lens of like, well, why is God so harsh? Why is God so intense? Why is God so violent? And it's, I think one answer that helps is understanding that the God in the Old Testament, which is, I believe, is the same God as Jesus, is really a God at war in a lot of ways. And his strategy is, okay, I'm going to pick one family, and through that one family, my plan to redeem the whole world will come. But this one family has to be protected at all costs. And so he uses hard power often to protect this family.
And not just protected, but like different. And so like the emphasis ends up being different too, because like it isn't just, like, you know, you can kind of just chill and be like everybody else, but just like say a couple of words differently. It's like, no, you have to be dramatically different in order to insulate yourself from the influences that will turn you into the very thing that everybody else is. And if everybody in the world is doing the same exact thing, there's no way that the world becomes different. There's no hope.
The world is lost. Phase. Then we just get back to the time of Noah again, where everyone's thoughts was evil continually. And I also think, I go back to that a lot too, studies with people, because I think we don't really comprehend what a world like that could possibly even be or look like, that everyone would be thinking evil constantly. I think that
just a point, like it's really interesting, because you think here in America, at least, like we are the police, and I'm not trying to argue for how police should be acting, or I'm just saying we are the police force mass quitting away from anarchy, you know, to a large degree, but we don't think of it that way because we have it. It's an institution, and we're bought into sort of a lot of the institutions that we have as a society. But when you don't have those institutions, like it's whoever's the most powerful uses their power however they choose to. And so like you also even have that in the equation as well, where you have these people. I mean, Genesis 11 with the Tower of Babel is sort of like a human power coming together to put ourselves on this sort of spiritual mountain, like that we're going to build a tower. It's going to be in the heavens. So we're going to be theoretically like gods in this way, or we're going to be meeting the gods in this way. And God's like, you're not that. And the more you keep thinking you're like that, the worse that this will continue to go. And so he does something about it in that moment. And like, yeah, we could always argue about why God did exactly what he did, but at least like when it comes to the issues that he's addressing, there seems to be just there's different considerations than we would have from our vantage point to then. If I stuck myself in that situation right then, and we're to ask ourselves, well, what hope is there for the world if the Israelites end up becoming just like the people around them, and they start becoming unjust, and they start becoming people who don't look at other people as made in the image of God, and if they start using
which they do
their own exactly, but like if you were to ask yourself in the midst of that, you'd be a prophet yelling at people saying like, you don't understand the damage that you're causing, and you don't understand the destruction that comes as a result of this, because you've pretty much given up yourself to the way of the world. You die by the sword. You live by the sword. You die by the sword. There's bigger nations around us. They're going to come take us out. Like you guys do not understand the promise that God has given us, which is he was going to be our personal God, our personal king, our personal protector in all of this, but not just a protector. He was going to bless us so that the world would be different because of us. That was the reality. Okay.
Yeah.
But that hasn't happened. And so like the stakes feel higher. I will, and like, I think that's a weird piece of it.
I agree.
When I go back and read the Old Testament, the stakes feel higher at certain points, which also seems to impact how God interacts with people or interacts with his people as a communal whole, versus a time now where it's like, go into the world. Yes, there's still high stakes, but God is interacting with a different phase of the world as opposed to what he was doing then. So I feel like there's still a lot of stuff we haven't covered in all of this, but yeah.
It's a big one. Big conversation.
John, do you have any thoughts?
Jesse and Anthony are completely wrong. Everything they said is incorrect.
Theology. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I could see.
Eric
I could
was thinking
that.
It was
you were
baloney
thinking
the whole
it.
Time.
Eric, you were thinking it. You knew they were wrong.
Yeah. I checked out an hour ago.
when he asked the question,
as did everyone else.
As soon as he has a question, just eyes glazed over.
Just instant regret, like, why did I ask?
This is a mistake.
No, it's just like you can approach this from so many different angles. That's what makes reading the Bible a lifelong meditation literature. It's like you go through and wrestle with it, and it's just it's not easy. It's not easy reading. Like, the Bible is not a kid's book. It's truly a messy journey of, and it's an account of life, which reflects what we have today, which is a total mess. So the same problem they had back then, and you've got psalmists crying out to God, like, why are you, the same questions you have, Eric, they were asking back then, like, God, where are you? What are you doing? And sometimes there was resolution where they're able to note at the end of a psalm, like, you're good, God. But there's other times that, you know, it ends with darkness is my closest friend. And like, it literally ends that way. And I think both are real accounts of people's experiences with that challenge. You know, we're faced with that challenge of, what do we do with who God is?
To speak to what you just said, Sean, like, the fact that there is resolution sometimes, there isn't resolution other times. Like, Jesus feels a lot more, what's the right word? Understandable, or like, resolved. There seems to be a resolution to it. But like, when you're thinking about a God who is God in the most wild ethereal sense of what that could even mean, like, you know, we could argue all these different things. He's God outside of time and space and all these things, but like, we don't even fully understand what we're even talking about God. And so how does that God introduce himself to us as he truly is in the greatness of that, while also introducing himself to us as he truly is, as he does in Jesus, like, as a quiet, close, personal God? Like, how do you bridge that dichotomy? I don't know, but I think that's actually, like you talked about in Job, how God can almost seem egotistical, like, with how he approaches that. But what's interesting is the answer at the end of Job isn't even really an answer. Like, yes, there is the blessing at the end, which is sort of like the nice bow on it, but I actually don't think that's the whole point of the book. I think it's an epilogue that's sort of like, and then this happened to him, right? But the actual answer at the end of the book is just God saying, Job, you've questioned me a lot, but where were you when I formed the foundations of the earth? And where, like, you don't even understand, like, the storehouses I have that are full of snow in the sky that, like, pour out, you know, it's just like, you have no context. I am who I am.
You don't have the perspective to criticize.
Yeah, which is why he also allows criticism. Like, he's not like destroying Job over that. But then also his answer is, I'm God. Like, I don't have to answer to you. And yet at the same time, all throughout scripture, we see a God who is at the very same time trying to answer to his people. Like, it's a wild thing. And so
it's a paradox.
That's and actually, to use that word, it's that paradox that I think ends up confusing us, because it's a piece of what confuses us, because, like, God is presenting himself in these ways that seem like Jesus doesn't present himself that way. But then we do have, like, moments where Jesus does present himself as, like, you got to eat my flesh, drink my blood. It's like, what the heck are you talking about, bro?
Yeah, what in the,
like, that's some ethereal thing that, like, I don't understand. That sounds crazy.
Or he like goes on the mountain and he's transfigured and he is, like, appears in his godness, and the disciples are like, holy crap.
Yeah.
They, like, fall on their face.
Yeah.
So, like, there's moments where that breaks into the Jesus story. And then there's moments where this God, who is so full of personal, close, intentional love, breaks into the I am the God King, you know, story. And so you see echoes both directions. And they actually, I think that's what's so powerful about living on the post side of Jesus, is that we can look back and we get to look through the lens of Jesus back into the Old Testament. But what's wild to me is that there were people all throughout the Old Testament who were calling God the God who is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in loyal love and faithfulness. And they kept calling him that, because in their context, they were experiencing him as such. And so it's like, it's a little bit to me, like, I'm not saying this, like, you shouldn't question this, but, like, when I then sit with all of that, it's like, oh shoot, if people in that time were saying, no, this God is this way, then they must know something about this or have an experience of this that means that that is true, versus my looking back and being like, well, why would he do it that way? And so, you know, maybe it was because of their culture, their time, their place, their experience with God. That in and of itself is maybe something to trust. Again, not an airtight answer as much as just like another piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. And I even think that upon examination, the more I've read the Old Testament, the more I think you, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, I see a personal God in it, but I think it just takes a lot more work because of the cultural separation. And I think we often, again, I keep coming back to this idea of cultural separation, but I think it's really significant because I think just the fact that the New Testament was written in Greek and the Old Testament was written in Hebrew is way more significant than we recognize. Like English comes from Greek, a lot of English words, right? It's like up through the Latin, like, you know, road, highway, right? Whereas Hebrew is like a totally foreign other language, and it's way older.
I almost switched from theology to religion major my last year of college because Hebrew sucked so much. It was just so dramatic.
Yeah, it's the worst.
It's all Greek to me.
Amen.
To be fair, we had a really bad Hebrew teacher in undergrad.
Anthony, careful. You never know who's listening, Anthony.
Hey, much love.
Don't say the name. We all had that teacher.
I'm not going to say the name.
Nice guy, and
I will say much love. I will say that I'm grateful because he passed me when I did not deserve to pass Hebrew 2, and I only graduated because of him. So I'm grateful. I just didn't learn Hebrew.
I took Hebrew right when I started dating Rochelle, and my grades took such a hit. Like the combination of Hebrew and not wanting to do Hebrew and also being in a relationship.
Also making out all the time.
And just such a dip in quality. And
all three of those things. Yeah. If it goes to show anything, I mean, you guys know me and you've known me most of my academic life. I got 96 in Hebrew 2 on the grad school level, and I got a 98 on my Hebrew 2 final.
Yeah, well, so AI didn't exist when you were in college, so.
You're right. ChatGPT didn't exist to teach me back then. Not saying that I use that. That's all hypothetical. Everything I've said here is hypothetical. Anyway, all this to say, Hebrew is way older than Greek, and I think it really shows because I think, like, to mine it, like you're mining for diamonds in Minecraft, it takes way more, I think, work and knowledge almost. Like, you literally kind of have to be a low-key scholar, I think, to see some of the things that are going on. Like, for instance, in the Job story, like you had mentioned earlier when you brought it up, like, God literally does all these things to him, and it's like they're playing this cosmic drama. But if you understand the Hebrew, you're able to understand the nuance of the conversation that that Satan and God have, where he says, Satan says to God, stretch out your hand and afflict him, and he'll stop worshiping you. And God doesn't even respond to that bait. And in the Hebrew, he says, yeah, you can do that, pretty much. He says, you do it. So in the whole story of Job, sometimes we read it as if God is doing these things, but he's really not. He gives Satan the power, or he pulls back his protection pretty much, and Satan is the one doing it the entire time. But in the story, every person attributes what's happening to God. So when the servants come,
and God never refutes that, which is really interesting.
He never refutes it. Which is really important. Yeah, so there's an interesting nuance happening where God isn't the one who's doing any of the things to Job, but all the people in the story think he is because they'll say, God sent fire from heaven and it destroyed all of your livestock. So they all attribute to him that he's doing it, but it's not him, and yet he shoulders the burden for all of it. He takes responsibility anyway, even though it wasn't him. So there's like little tiny nuggets, little nuances like that where you're just like, oh, interesting. This is the like redemptive God that sometimes it's hard to see. He's working in the background. It's just a little harder to see, I think, at times, a lot, because we're so culturally removed.
So, Eric, in the face of overwhelming theological might,
overwhelming theological girth,
have you capitulated in all of your heresy? No, I'm just kidding. I mean, yeah, like honestly, hearing some of this stuff, does it shift any perspective, or is there pieces of it that still stand out as like, yeah, this piece still doesn't make sense? Or
I think it's one of those things where it's going to take a while for me to kind of think through and process all this stuff. Cause you guys have said a lot, and definitely some of it has been a lot of it has been, you know, thought provoking. So I don't know. It almost feels like we need to do like a follow up episode at some point. But
hey guys, yeah, welcome to Speaking with Free Scott. Like Eric is no longer with the podcast.
Due to some unforeseen complications.
I'm a deliberator. I'm a heavy deliberator. Just ask my wife. It can be frustrating sometimes. But so I'll just have to, yeah, to sit with this overnight and longer. But I think I think maybe one of the big questions that I'm kind of going through my mind is maybe somewhat the way that I personally, I guess, view God and how he interacts with humanity and the individual. I guess, I don't know, maybe it's kind of getting to Anthony's point about
like communal our culture versus
our kind
individual?
Of modern culture, so like individual focused, and it's kind of about individual fulfillment for better and for worse. That I think that does like largely shape modern Christianity as well. Mm. And I don't know, it's like I guess this is like a whole other discussion you could go into. But I guess how that really stacks up against the Bible.
How modern culture and what it causes us to see stacks up against what the Bible really says. Is that what you mean?
I think it's not going to be eloquent, but basically to try to put it plainly, I think as Christians in the modern day, it's easy to just look at the whole scripture and be like, what is the heart of it is like salvation, right? And we think of salvation, at least I tend to think of salvation as like personal, individual salvation for each person.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a lot of the Bible is not that way as much. It's more salvation for humanity.
Yeah.
Maybe to put it one way.
Yeah.
And so,
which is made up of individuals, but yeah, it's like you're right. As Anthony said earlier, a restorative heart and hope for humanity. Yeah.
Right.
Which I think the Old Testament writers, I think you're right in that they view that primarily communally, not primarily individually, because that was the culture they lived in.
Right. So I guess I wonder, yeah, like I said, this could be a whole huge discussion of kind of that communal versus individual and salvation for each individual versus humanity as a whole. But I don't know. It's kind of just thoughts going through my head, I guess, of, in modern Christianity, do we put too much focus on the individual salvation? I'm not saying we do. I wonder, is that
I think we have
part of what leads to that hard to wrestle those two? Because it does, I feel like, Old Testament does feel much more like salvation for the Jews or salvation for humanity versus like each individual person.
The group rather than the person.
And to speak on that a little bit, like, I think we have historically in Christianity focused so much on the individual salvation, which is a big piece of it. But but what's so interesting is that we still want and need and care about communal salvation. And we want a God that will show up and say that certain things are wrong and that certain things are right. And we want a God who's going to come and he's going to deal with what is evil and what is good. And we want all of those things, but we primarily think of it like through the lens of, will I get to heaven someday? And so I think that there's a whole movement right now that's fighting against that. Like almost all the authors that I read now are not speaking about like individual human salvation. as a primary mm-hmm. lens. They're talking about, you know, the restoration of humanity, of a new earth, a new kingdom someday, where in the age to come, where we're all going to be, restored to what we're supposed to be, and building something good together. That's a beautiful story. But as soon as we get too individually focused, then all of a sudden we don't need a God who has wrath against evil. We just need a God who will be nice to me, right? And so then when we see a God who has wrath against evil, we're like, I don't like that, because that doesn't solve the problem that I feel like I have. But then as soon as you start to zoom out from that and you start to see the state of humanity, now a God who's going to show up and be a God who says, no, enough is enough, we're done with this, man, now I start wanting that God really bad. Not just so I can get to heaven someday, but so that like all of this would cease at some point, you know? And so, I don't know. It's like, I do think I guess I'm saying all that to say that I do think that what we're bringing to the text ends up really shaping what kind of God we end up wanting.
Oh yeah.
Right. No, I think that's very true. I think that's something that in my personal life, I think everybody's this way, but, increasingly I'm trying to, I guess, find more about the truth of who God is as much as we can find it, versus like who I want God to be. Right. Make sure I'm not just painting a picture of God the way I want him to look, but like the way that the Bible actually presents him. And that's maybe why I'm like starting to like reexamine a lot of these questions. Exactly. Like,
that's a powerful pursuit.
Understand this better than I maybe.
Can you guys imagine Holy God appearing in all of his holy might to some peasant in 4000 BC and just one day, just an explosion, and just saying, hey, you're an individual, not a community. You have individual rights. And guess what? I'm here to give you personal salvation.
That'd be pretty wild.
I just, and that's a joke.
Also,
peasant
just dies.
Yeah, probably. I think it's illustrating kind of what we're talking about, that like we're so inundated, like it's just the water we swim in our worldview. Like we're so inundated in just the worldview that like I'm an individual first. And so we relate to our faith that way, and we almost can't not, because we're just products of the 21st century, and we can't not be. But I think therein lies, like, which I think is beautiful what you just said, therein lies like the gift, I think, of the Old Testament, because it's presenting a cultural perspective of God that's so foreign to us, but it's still just as true. And I think it gives us truths that are rich but difficult to grasp.
Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate your thoughts.
Nice, short, quick
answer.
It's
getting late.
Yeah. Eric, what's your next question? What's your next big question going to be about?
Yeah, give us a little teaser.
I'm really hoping.
You know, I think maybe what I'd like to get into, which is kind of a continuation almost of this discussion, is why did God choose to come down in such an ungodlike way? Ungodlike, in quotes.
Like human baby, we're talking?
Right. I'm just, why did he choose to do it that way and make it such a issue of faith in a way?
I think
God make it a big question to like, why is this real? Is this not? When it seems like he could have seemingly easily made it like, well, that
yeah,
was
like obvious.
Clearly God. So
appear no on the moon, there. A big face. Yeah.
So. That's kind of a question.
Teletubby son.
Teletubby son. I'm God.
Come on.
Eric, my not honest answer to that is I think that God was just like, you know,
hey,
what?
Not tonight.
No. I just think that God was like, you know what?
This isn't going to be
real. Dealing with you guys has been, you guys act like such babies. I'm going to show you what it feels like to deal with you. And he's just like, here I come.
I'm going to come as a baby.
Here I come.
Just to give you the hassle.
I'm going to have a blowout just because I want to. So, you know.
Holy
non-parents, for any non-parents who haven't experienced your child blowing out into their car seat in the middle of your road trip, you'll never know.
I've never been there.
So,
it's because you're divorced. In the buckle, the little...
I knew there'd have to be one divorce joke in this episode.
Eric, we don't have the sound effects on this one.
Yeah, there's no,
but
no more sound effects.
I'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah,
we'll get those back. Actually, Jesse, I have experienced that. Leo has had a terrible blowout on a trip.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, I forgot.
It's not the same.
Animal, having an animal is just like having a human child. I forgot about that part. Yeah, for sure.
It's close.
It's the same thing. No. Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. Again, I hope this is helpful to some of the listeners out there that might be having similar questions. I think obviously a goal for all of us with this podcast is to always have honest conversations and try to keep it real. So
sure.
I don't want to pretend like I have all my worldview figured out. I guess to open up to, you know, listeners, if you have questions like this, feel free to
shoot them our way.
DM us on Instagram is probably the best way to get a hold of us, or email usually works too. So check the show notes if you want to send a question, and then maybe a year and a half from now we can actually get to it. But
exactly, or just a couple weeks. I just responded to one; it only took me 2 weeks. So
you know, my guess is if we get a lot, there'll probably be some general themes that we can pull from, and hopefully, actually, you know, be helpful to people through this podcast and not just spewing hot garbage into the air. So, but yeah. Thanks, guys.
Awesome.
Thank you, guys.
I guess.
Hey, friends. You've just been listening to another episode of Seeking What They Sought. I'm one of your hosts, Anthony Leiter, and on behalf of all the guys, we just want to say a big thank you to all of you who have come alongside us in our journey to have honest conversations about Adventism. We appreciate each one of you. As usual, if you haven't already, give us a follow on Instagram. It is kind of like our home base, social media-wise, and if you'd like to stay up to date on the episodes that we're posting or just different things that we're doing, you can follow us there. We're also kind of like low-key a meme account, and we post silly videos and other stuff. So give us a follow. We would love it. Also want to say a big thank you to our patrons, and we're really grateful to each one of you for helping us make quality content. So to each one of you, a big thank you. And if you'd like to follow us on Patreon, you can. There's a link in our Instagram bio if you'd like to support us. Thank you so much. Last but not least, if you could you leave us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen, because it really helps us actually in the algorithm to help new people get their eyes on the podcast. So if you could just go in, give us a little, hopefully a 5-star review, but you know, be honest, that really helps us just in the algorithm, the way that, you know, these things work these days. So we really, really appreciate it. All right, I think that's it for now, friends. So we will see you next time on Seeking What They Sought.